From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Vice President Mike Pence speaks at the Republican National Convention tonight. Last night, First Lady Melania Trump broke with other speakers and acknowledged the racial strife in the country as well as deaths from the coronavirus.
I want to acknowledge the fact that since March, our lives have changed drastically. The invisible enemy, COVID-19, swept across our beautiful country and impacted all of us. My deepest sympathy goes out to everyone who has lost a loved one, and my prayers are with those who are ill or suffering.
Joining us now is NPR White House correspondent Tamara Keith. Tam, the First Lady spoke from the White House Rose Garden, which is unusual, and President Trump staged a naturalization ceremony in the White House last night for this convention. He also gave a surprise pardon to a convicted bank robber who's turned his life around. Tell us about the unprecedented use of the White House and presidential power in a very political convention.
Yeah, there is a complete and total blurring of the official and the political. You had the White House, at the White House, the president conducting this naturalization ceremony yesterday, as we understand it, during the day. Then the White House posted the video to the White House YouTube page. That video was then picked up and aired as part of the RNC convention. It is unusual. It is unheard of. There is a law called the Hatch Act that is meant to prevent the blurring of these lines and prevent public officials from doing electoral politics on government time and using government resources. The White House is trying to skirt around these rules. And we should just say that President Trump and his staff have been accused of violating the Hatch Act many times before during his administration, and they've largely just brushed it off.
Well, and on that note, by the way, there was another speech last night that's raising some red flags. Democrats in Congress say they will investigate Secretary of State Mike Pompeo for giving a political speech to the convention from an official diplomatic mission overseas. Listen.
I'm speaking to you from beautiful Jerusalem, looking out over the old city. I have a big job as Susan's husband and Nick's dad. Susan and Nick are more safe and their freedoms more secure because President Trump has put his America First vision into action. It may not have made him popular in every foreign capital, but it's worked.
Tamara, secretaries of state don't speak at political conventions typically, do they?
They purposely avoid it. They sometimes go to other parts of the world to be nowhere near the convention. Of course, Secretary of State Pompeo was in Jerusalem, and the State Department has said that no official resources were used for that video. And as you heard there, he said, "My job is to be Susan's husband and Nick's dad." Wink, wink, nod, nod. As if to say, no, I'm not here as the Secretary of State. I'm just here as a guy. This is just yet another example of the blurring of these lines. And, you know, there's a reason why Secretaries of State have avoided this, which is that, you know, politics is supposed to stop at the water's edge. The State Department frequently tells other countries that they shouldn't have this sort of use of the apparatus of government for politics, and yet here it was happening.
What does Mike Pence, the vice president, have to do tonight? He, of course, has led the coronavirus task force, and more than 178,000 Americans have died from the disease so far.
Yeah, and he'll be speaking from Fort McHenry in Baltimore, which is the site of the battle that inspired Francis Scott Key to write the Star Spangled Banner. He is the vice president, and people generally know him. The thought is that he may try to show a little more teeth or a little more criticism of former Vice President Biden and his running mate. We will see what that speech actually contains. Mike Pence is not traditionally known as the attack dog of the administration. Traditionally, President Trump has just taken that on his own,
right,
with relish.
Well, and we'll probably hear from President Trump again, as we have the last couple of nights. Tamara Keith, NPR White House.
It will be a surprise.
That's right. It will be a surprise. Tamara, thank you.
You're welcome.
Let's go now to Kenosha, Wisconsin, where two people were killed and a third injured last night at a protest for Jacob Blake, a black man who was shot by police as he was reaching into his car where his three young children were waiting for him. Blake is alive, but partially paralyzed, and the city of Kenosha is in the midst of unrest. And for more, let's bring in Alderman Anthony Kennedy, who represents the 10th District of Kenosha. Alderman, thank you for being here.
Thank you for the opportunity.
And last night, as I mentioned, we saw another night of tense protests. Two people were shot and killed and a third injured. We're hearing there were two protests earlier in the day, a peaceful march and a protest near the courthouse. And then later in the night, another more chaotic scene after that 8 p.m. curfew. Tell us what you know.
I was able to witness a good deal of that second incident in the evening. My friend Ray Roberts and my friend County Board Supervisor Andy Berg set up a Facebook live feed where they were discussing issues and bringing up different feeds to see what was going on in the city of Kenosha. And one of the feeds they brought up showed the situation just about 20 to 30 seconds before the shooting happened. There was a confrontation. In that confrontation, you see people coalescing around that. You hear the shots fired. You see that little crowd disperse, and then the shooter walks past the person who is filming and goes to up the street. He trips, falls. The crowd that was near them starts to converge on him. The person starts shooting from the ground. And I saw this as it was happening because of the feed that my friend Ray Roberts and Andy Berg were broadcasting. There were no Kenosha police officers in the vicinity. Their line that they had set up was about 4-5 blocks to the north of where this was happening. So any narrative that talks about the Kenosha police were involved in this or was complacent or allowed it to happen, that is a weaponization of information that is literally going to destroy my neighborhood.
You have said that you're heartbroken over what is happening there in Kenosha. Blake's sister has said, this is nothing new, though. She's not sad. She's actually angry. And protesters have said this, too. You've been an alderman of the 10th District since 2008. Where is the breakdown between police and communities there that protesters are contending? And do you feel a sense of responsibility in this at all as an alderman?
As a city alderman, I absolutely feel a sense of responsibility. I am part of this system. It would be a falsehood for me to try to divorce myself from this. Watching the video of Mr. Blake and his engagement with my police department was absolutely heartbreaking. There is no way you have any kind of humanity and not be affected by that. Shock, disbelief because the police department that is being pictured on that video is a disconnect from the men and women that I have worked with, who I have asked to help improve the quality of life of my constituents for the last 12 years. The people who, it was almost as if I'm watching a fiction. And that was not an indication of what I thought my police department was about.
Alderman, there has been, though, a contentious relationship between Kenosha police and residents. There was another death that rocked Kenosha 16 years ago, the death of Michael Bell Jr. He was a 21-year-old white man who was also shot by police. And because of that incident, Michael Bell's father pushed for reforms that now require the state to investigate cases involving Kenosha police. Do you have faith in that process?
I have respect for what Mr. Bell has done. He has taken a tragedy that I cannot imagine any father losing their son. And he's taken that tragedy and he has made some reforms happen in the state of Wisconsin. And I thank Mr. Bell for that effort because I think we are in a better place because of it.
In a better place, but the call from protesters is more. They want more to happen. This is a small city with 100,000 people. I can hear in your voice that you feel a tremendous amount of sadness about what's happening to your community. But what conversations or actions do you see coming out of what's happening now? What do you want to see happen?
One, and this might be Pollyanna pie in the sky, but I have been accused by the people I have engaged in the neighborhood, in the community, that I'm a liar, that I am the puppet for the system. I work at a certain level. I don't have the luxury of just being angry. I have to be angry and productive, and I'm going to ask my constituents to please join me in that.
That was Anthony Kennedy, alderman for the 10th District in Kenosha, Wisconsin, where two people were killed and a third injured last night at a protest over the shooting of Jacob Blake. At last night's Republican National Convention, culturally conservative women were front and center, with strong opinions against abortion, bathroom bills for transgender students, and a general appeal by First Lady Melania Trump to the mothers of this country.
To mothers and parents everywhere, you are warriors. In my husband, you have a president who will not stop fighting for you and your families.
But polls show a significant portion of women have deserted Trump. A recent NPR PBS NewsHour Marist poll released in June shows 66% of women disapprove of the president. I connected with two longtime supporters of the president who believe, despite the polls, that Trump actually does have a second chance. Susan Sherman of Lake Mary, Florida, just outside of Orlando, and Sonia McMasters of Round Rock, Texas, a suburb just outside of Austin. I started by asking Susan what issues are top of mind for her and her neighbors.
Well, many issues for myself and those in Central Florida. A lot of their issues is the country may be turning towards socialism, concern of defunding the police, rioting happening. So there's different topics that have truly have come up since COVID. You never really heard anyone really talk about these three until after COVID really started.
Do you see those talking points as really showing the reality, the truth of where this country is headed, and really the conversations that are being had about defunding police organizations? You're against defunding the police, but President Trump has also had in his 2019 budget plan, the Trump administration was proposing a nearly 50% cut to the COPS hiring program, which hires local police officers. We hear that in his 2021 budget plan, there are also plans for cuts. What do you say to that?
He has to do a budget just like anyone else. So if he has to reduce that budget and move it to other areas, then yes, it's just like running a business. With that being said, then it has to go back to your state, your county, and your city to do their budgeting.
Sonia, do you want to weigh in here?
The city of Austin defunded our police department in the city of Austin already in their budget. We've had major riots here in Austin, and then they get mad because they want protection while they're doing this.
But you mentioned Austin. Austin City Council cut the police department budget by one third. They did not defund the entire police department. And so in thinking about that, I mean, I'm thinking about how polarized we are as Americans. And the conversations that we're having seem to be where we're not talking to each other, even though we're talking about the same things. I mean, this is one example of this. Do you see what I'm saying here?
I can see your point on that. But at the same time, they want money taken away from the police department. They really don't want a police department because they want to do whatever they want. They want to go back to the olden days of the Wild Wild West. That is my opinion on it. Mm-hmm. It may not be everybody else's opinion, but I respect my police department.
Sonia, some are calling this election a referendum on how President Trump has handled the pandemic in the U.S. There are more than 5 million cases now. More than 175,000 people have died. And the president has gone back and forth on mask wearing as a means of protection. Are you happy with Trump's response to this health crisis?
Oh, yes. I'm very happy because you got to remember, we survived the swine flu. We've survived the Spanish flu. We have survived other flus that have surpassed in here, and we've never had to treat it the way we are treating this one. Yeah, it's good to be careful, but at the same time, we got to move on and we got to survive out of it.
Mm-hmm. So what you're saying there, though, I mean, the swine flu, some would argue it was the measures that the Obama administration took to stop that from becoming a pandemic. What are your thoughts on this?
China is already up and running and with walking around with no masks and stuff. So I know in the future it's going to come for us.
Susan, I heard you agreeing with Sonia on this point, that we have been in this position somewhat before and that we were able to survive it. But to what Sonia is saying, though, about other places, the difference is that leaders in those countries took swift action. Are you satisfied with the way that the president has handled this pandemic?
To be quite honest, we still don't know the true numbers. Every day they come out different, if it's a false positive, if it's positive. So my concern is, what are the true numbers of how many are truly new testing being done? I think we're doing the right things that we need to. But yes, I think the administration is doing right with the numbers and with the information that they are receiving.
Susan, you're the president of the Suburban Republicans Women's Club. Does Trump's assertions that we need to defend the suburbs, an idea that was reiterated on the first night of the RNC by the McCloskeys, resonate with you? And if so, why? What does suburban living mean to you?
So how I would put it for the state of Florida in particular is we have 1,000 people moving to Florida a day. So when you have 1,000 people moving into Florida a day, it is concerned because now we're going to need more housing. We're going to need more apartments, more single family homes. The individuals or families that are moving are from the bigger cities. They're moving from New York, New Jersey, California. So they're moving from Democratic states into the state of Florida. And so with that comes different views of what that would look like.
Some would say this definition, though, and what you're trying to protect is the idea of an all-white suburb. I mean, is racial diversity what you're protecting the suburbs from?
No, I don't. I don't view it as race. I view it as the ideology when others are coming from other states, what their views are and how it will affect our state, our county, and our cities. Doesn't matter race. It's more of how we will change our school districts. You know, we have great school districts here in Seminole County. So when you bring that ideology in, it's going to stir it up. And that's the change that they're afraid of.
Sonia, I think I heard you try to pipe in there for a moment. Yes. What were you saying?
Yeah, I highly agree with her response on this, because I'm going to tell you, I am a Hispanic Latina woman. We are in the state of Texas still seeing a lot of people moving from California, state of Washington, Illinois. A lot of people of those states are moving to Texas, and they are going to need housing. And I'll tell you from experience, I sit on the Housing Authority Board in the town that I live in, and I see how hard it is for us to try to help the needy. And at the same time, when you have a little town that doesn't have no more boundaries to grow on, how are these people are going to find places to live?
Sonia, I want to ask you more about that, because the suburb you live in is just outside of Austin. You grew up by the border. What's your opinion about the Trump immigration policy and calls to make a wall? I mean, what do you want to see him do?
I want that wall to completely protect the United States. It's not for reasonings of trying to separate two countries from each other. I want it to separate the criminals from coming into our country. The thing that hurts me the most is that the media surpasses this to become a crazy wild thing when it's not.
What do you mean by that?
People are willing to comply. I mean, I've seen pictures and videos of people that are waiting in Arizona, waiting in New Mexico, waiting in the borders cities of Texas, where they're waiting for their documents. They're filling out their documents to get permission to come across instead of doing it illegally.
Susan, I hear you agreeing in part to what Sonia has said. I want to also ask you more about some of Trump's statements. So we've heard from some GOP voters who are turned off by President Trump's use of Twitter specifically. The company itself has had to flag many of his statements as inflammatory or misleading. How do you feel about his Twitter account?
I do hear that all the time. I actually even have a lot of voters to say they don't want to vote for him just because of Twitter. And I always tell everyone when you vote, you always should have three issues of whoever you're choosing, because you're never going to have the perfect candidate. And that's only one issue. Twitter, in my opinion, he uses because he gets so frustrated with the other side trying to make, you know, laws pass, make deals work, whatever it happens to. And he gets so frustrated they don't work that he uses Twitter. And it's kind of like, here, let me throw something out there that you can talk about this while I get something done.
Is there any part of you, though, that thinks that what he says on Twitter is representative of his ability to lead?
I think he's a human being just like all of us, and we can say what we like to say. He can use Twitter just as much as you and I can use Twitter. Do I think he should maybe back off a little? Yes. You know, does he need to be using it every day? Should he be responding to everything? No. But him using it, cutting him off completely, I would say no.
For both of you, you know, in the end, when Americans cast their ballots this November, they're voting for what they want the future to be. So for both of you, what is the America that you want to see? And I'll start with you, Sonia.
I want everybody to stop hating each other when they don't need to hate each other.
Susan.
I agree with that, that we still have our free speech. We still have our Second Amendment. And everyone that lives here can live their dreams. They have the ability, no matter their background, their race, their culture, any of that does not matter. Everyone should have the right to provide for their families, to give their children whatever they desire.
That's Susan Sherman of Lake Mary, Florida, and Sonia McMasters of Round Rock, Texas. Thank you both for taking the time with us today.
Thank you, Tanya.
Thank you, Tanya. We appreciate that.
Idaho lawmakers are back at the state capitol today after police there wheeled anti-government activist Ammon Bundy out of the complex yesterday in an office chair. He's been charged with trespassing and resisting and obstructing officers, all amid protests over the state's special legislative session related to the coronavirus pandemic. NPR's Kirk Siegler is in Boise. Kirk, people remember Ammon Bundy for his armed occupation of that wildlife refuge in Oregon in 2016. Remind us of who he is and how he's connected to these recent protests.
Well, right. Bundy was acquitted for his role in leading that 41-day armed siege that you mentioned of a federal bird sanctuary not far from here over in Oregon, and also a separate but related case over an armed standoff near his family's ranch in Nevada collapsed in a mistrial. So, you know, Jeremy, he's free and you might say emboldened, and the pandemic has really brought new life into this so-called patriot movement that he's a leader of. You know, they're always looking for something that's perceived as government overreach. So Bundy, who lives in Idaho now, has been leading all kinds of controversial protests lately since the lockdowns hit, disrupting a public meeting in defiance of mask orders, trying to get the governor here recalled over a statewide stay-at-home order he implemented. And when the legislature met in special session, as you mentioned, this week, here was Bundy saying his people and their voices were being shut out.
Well, and his arrest, or his being wheeled out, I suppose, his being wheeled out of,
exactly,
of the complex yesterday was after things got out of hand earlier this week. On Monday, protesters who were not wearing masks for COVID-19 pushed through police to get into the legislative chamber. A glass door was broken and it was caught on video. Listen to this. They're saying, this is our house. What were these people protesting exactly?
Well, right. And Bundy was front and center there. It's sometimes an open question and never black and white, to be honest, with Bundy. But there were a lot of anti-vaxxers, conspiracy theorists, of which there are many in Idaho. Remember, this state is famous for far-right extremism, and there are plenty of far-right elected officials here who would sympathize with Bundy. To sum it up, though, the main thing they seem to have wanted is the state to not be able to enforce coronavirus restrictions.
Hmm. And did the police just stand by and let this happen earlier this week?
initially sort of, but you keep mentioning the wheeling. You know, it was chaos and disorder, and there was pressure to do something by yesterday. Even a lot of the Republican leaders here seemed pretty furious. So at one point, the House Speaker ordered a hearing room to be cleared, and most of those protesters you heard there in civil disobedience, they left. But there was Bundy and two others. They refused to leave. He was sitting at a table that was ordinarily reserved for press. And it was like truly bizarre scene. He was on this swivel office chair, and the state police came over, handcuffed him to the chair, moved him out to an elevator, wheeled him down to the first floor, and literally right out onto the street and into a squad car that was waiting for them. And so then he was transferred and, of course, booked into the local county jail.
So just a few seconds left here, but what is the legislature trying to do this week? And is this putting pressure on them to not do it or to do it more?
It's puzzling because some of the bills they're going to consider, you might expect the far right would like, including one that would strip authority away from local health districts to enforce things like mask restrictions and other things and give that back to local school boards. And the governor has, for the most part, a lot of the restrictions have been lifted.
That is NPR's Kirk Siegler in Boise. Kirk, thank you. There are some companies that have actually done better during the pandemic than before. Think Zoom, for example, or the meal kit delivery company Blue Apron, because so many more people are cooking at home. It reported 10% profit growth in the second quarter this year compared to the same period last year. Blue Apron President and CEO Linda Findley-Kozlowski joins us on Skype as part of View from the Top, our series of conversations with leaders. Linda, welcome. And for people who have never used a meal kit delivery service, tell us briefly how Blue Apron works.
You know, it's interesting because I think a lot of people, given meal kits are still so new, aren't quite clear exactly what they're for, or they wonder, is it just really about convenience or not going to the store? And the reality is the reason people find meal kits attractive actually sort of falls into three buckets. One is meal planning. It's actually the primary reason that people find our kits to be very attractive is because that stress over 4 p.m., what are we going to have for dinner tonight? Families argue about it all the time, feeling like they're in a rut. So it's really just helping with that planning and removing that stress with really great recipes that provide a lot of variety for your family or your loved ones that you're cooking with. Number two is actually about convenience of having some of the best ingredients delivered straight to your door. We have very, very high sourcing standards and work directly with producers to make sure that you're getting best quality food. And then the final piece is actually lack of food waste. We hear a lot of complaints from people that in their homes they bought too many carrots for a recipe and they don't know what to do with the rest of them and they wind up throwing out too much food and that feels really stressful. But the reality is there's a lot of food waste in the industry in general. So we've really focused on reducing the food waste both in our supply chain and then also in people's homes. So you're getting great meals, but you're not feeling like you're having to buy a giant jar of sauce for something where you only might need a small amount or buying too much produce that goes bad too quickly.
At the same time, you say you're reducing food waste. There's also the issue of packaging, though, and I know that this is something that's come up over the years with Blue Apron. How much of your packaging at this point is recyclable?
More than 80% of our packaging is recyclable and reusable, and we continue to optimize that and try to make more and more of it recyclable. But the interesting part about it is there's a University of Michigan study that actually found that even with the packaging, we're still a third lower carbon footprint than going to the grocery store because of not just the food waste, but the packaging and the supply chain as well of traditional grocery. So even though we continue to strive to make the packaging better and we are participating in the How to Recycle program and the first kit to do that, we are actually seeing benefits already from the fact that we have narrowed down our food waste and our packaging quite a bit.
What about the fact, though, that China, for example, is not taking our recycling anymore after that 2018 ban? Are you confident that the packaging that you give people that is recyclable doesn't just end up in a landfill somewhere?
Our hope is to make sure that cities and counties are really doing everything they can to continue recycling programs. And we're big advocates for making sure that we are keeping all recycling channels open, not just frankly for Blue Apron materials, but for materials in general. You know, as people are buying more at home from the pandemic, we are seeing more packaging out there. There's another part to recycling, though, that's really important is education about how to recycle, which is why we've participated in this program. Because many people don't even know that things that say that they're compostable aren't always compostable based on different city and county regulations and different programs. So we want to make sure that people know how to make sure that their materials get to recycling effectively.
Okay. And then you mentioned the carbon footprint. Let me just press you on that for a second, because obviously the things that are being delivered to your customers have to be moved from one place to another. You're saying that even given that, there's still a lower carbon footprint from Blue Apron products than if you went to the grocery store?
Right. So that's, again, the independent study that was done by the University of Michigan last year that actually traced, including the transportation aspect of it. Because, again, think about it. The food that comes into the grocery supply chain also does need to be transported as well. But food waste really is the biggest culprit. And a big part of what we do is, because we use technology to understand exactly what people are ordering, we can source exactly what's needed for the kits, send customers exactly what they need. If there is any overage, we offer that first to our employees through our farmers market program, and then the rest goes to donations like City Harvest to make sure that it's feeding people directly.
How has your supply chain been affected by the pandemic?
So because we have such a very tight supply chain, we actually have multiple ways that we can be flexible if we need to, based on availability and freshness of ingredients. Because of the fact that we are using fresh ingredients in our recipes, we want to make sure that if something isn't the best quality, that we can adapt the recipe and switch to a different ingredient. That flexibility has worked well for us during the pandemic, because we're able to manage and work with our suppliers to make sure that we have minimal disruption in our supply chain. What we're particularly proud of is, because of the quality of ingredients that we source, we have longstanding relationships with these suppliers, and also we audit them for the same safety and sanitation standards that we have in our facilities, which is extremely high. And so we're very confident that we're able to manage through that, the fluctuations in supply chain, without impacting the quality of what we send to the customers.
So we mentioned that you've seen revenue growth this year, especially as more people have been cooking at home during the pandemic. Do you think that your growth will sustain after life returns to normal, which I assume at some point it will?
Let's hope that it does return to normal as soon as possible. What we're hearing from our customers, and what we're also seeing the third-party research out there, is that habits are changing. And what people have been doing during the pandemic, as far as cooking at home more, et cetera, at least a third of people plan to continue to cook at home, even more so than they did during the pandemic, even after things start to open up again. They've started to see value in the connection with family and the cost savings that comes from cooking at home. And so all the research points to the fact that people will continue to cook at home more after the pandemic, even than they did during the pandemic or beforehand.
So the meal kit industry is getting busier, as you know. You've got HelloFresh, Plated, Sunbasket, Purple Carrot, just to name a few. What do you have to do at Blue Apron to stand apart from the competition?
So we feel very confident that one of our best assets is our culinary authority. So the reality is, we constantly create new recipes. We have an in-house team of culinary experts that really know how to layer flavor. We're able to include more unique ingredients in our kits that you might find at more specialty stores if you were actually shopping for them, and more unique ingredients than what we necessarily see from our competitors. So you can get layers of flavor in your recipes, really high quality proteins that meet high animal welfare standards, great quality produce in the kits. Beyond that, we try to give people a lot of choice when it comes to flexibility around what their health needs are. We offer different sort of low-carb options. We're partnered with the American Diabetes Association, WW. We also offer Mediterranean options that people can use to mix and match and choose their own path when it comes to health and enjoyment. So even if you're being healthy, you don't feel like you're sacrificing anything in the process.
Mm-hmm. So I have a question just out of curiosity, and I'm sure that you have the answer, although maybe not at your fingertips, but I'll try anyway. What is the most popular recipe? What are Americans into these days when it comes to Blue Apron?
Oh, that's actually a very interesting question. So we are known for our burgers, I have to say. The combination of the quality of the meat that we use, as well as the recipes and the techniques, because we're big believers in not just giving you what you need in order to make something, but teaching you how to make it better. And we definitely have some really great potato buns that we put in the package as well. I will say it is interesting during the pandemic, because you're seeing a mix of people wanting to look at some comfort foods. So you are seeing a lot of pastas and noodles and that sort of thing. But then also a lot of people during the summer are very focused on health. And so our fish dishes are some of the best dishes out there. And it's one of those dishes where people feel really confident cooking fish after using our box. So we're seeing an interesting split in our customers where both the comfort food side of the menu and the health side of the menu are getting a lot of love in the process.
And what's the thing that probably will have to come off the menu because nobody wants it?
Well, we try not to have too many of those things because we do collect quite a bit of data and we really focus on our customer reviews and we continue to adapt our recipes based on that. But honestly, there's not many things on the menu that have to come off at this point because we're pretty good about managing that based on customer reviews. Our customers love our product and they also tell us when they don't like a recipe quite as much. Hmm.
That is Linda Findley-Kozlowski, the president and CEO of Blue Apron. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
I thought she was going to say something involving Brussels sprouts, although Brussels sprouts are hot now, so people like them again.
At least 5 states have rolled out apps to help people alert their contacts if they've contracted COVID-19. Eventually, 20 states and territories plan to release their own apps, covering 45% of the U.S. population. That's according to Google, which helped develop this technology. The first, called COVIDWISE, made a debut in Virginia earlier this month. And let's bring in Jeffrey Fowler, technology columnist for The Washington Post, with more. Hi, Jeffrey.
Hi there.
So you and your team of staffers at The Washington Post have been testing this app, COVIDWISE, and how is it supposed to work? Does it seem like it does what it's promising to do?
Well, the idea is that if you run this app in the background on your phone, it just is running all the time and it's keeping track of other people that you come in contact with within at least 6 feet for 15 minutes. And if one of them later gets a positive coronavirus diagnosis, the system will anonymously send an alert and you'll get to know on your through your phone that maybe you should get a coronavirus test as well. That is the promise. It's like the world's most stressful kind of alert you could possibly get from your phone. It says, you know, you may have been exposed. Mm. The big question is, of course, does it work? And the truth is, we still don't really know. There were 35 Washington Post staffers in the state of Virginia that were helping me test this app. Over 2 week period, none of them got any alerts. Now, that could just mean that Washington Post staffers were doing a very good job of remaining socially distant. That could also mean that just not enough people out there have been using the app yet for people to be exposed, you know, to folks who might get a positive coronavirus diagnosis. So we just don't know.
Yeah. These apps use technology from Apple and Google, but they were developed for public health agencies. Where is the data going? Are you confident that tech companies are keeping their word about not using this technology to track users for ads and those sorts of things?
Yeah, that is kind of the core question here. I think the real stumbling block to people in the United States in particular, but all around the world, to trusting these sorts of apps is that we don't really trust either tech companies or the government to track us. And with good reason, right? I mean, we learned from Edward Snowden that the government, you know, tracks the lives of citizens in lots of ways people might not like. And we've all learned from using Facebook and watching Mark Zuckerberg in front of Congress that tech companies aren't to be trusted either. I'm someone, as a columnist for The Post, who recommends being very wary about installing apps and browsers that might track you. But in this case, I was very pleasantly surprised. Now, we looked beneath the code on these apps, and they're actually not collecting any information about your location at all. Instead, they're using this really kind of sophisticated trick of using the Bluetooth signals on your phone to keep track of who you might come nearby and then deleting that record after 14 days.
Okay, so then, I mean, on the other hand, you also write that the focus on privacy also means health officials get almost no useful data from these apps. So can they be used for contact tracing in this way?
That's been one of the most controversial elements of these apps among public health officials. They say, okay, you know, at best, this is an individual alert system. It might let you know as an individual you should go get tested, but it doesn't really help public health officials as a whole figure out where hotspots are and also do what's called contact tracing, right? Where they go and they find the exact individual people who might have been exposed. These apps can't let them do any of that. In fact, when you get an alert through one of these exposure notification apps, it won't tell you when exactly it happened or where exactly it happened or who you might have been exposed to. It just lets you know that you should go get a test.
Okay. You mentioned how you and your colleagues have used this app. These apps are supposed to encourage people who might have been exposed to someone with the virus to go get tested. Is there any evidence that they're pushing people to get tested who wouldn't otherwise have done so?
Yeah, so far the state of Virginia hasn't reported, you know, how many cases that they think were people who got notified through the app. They've said that about 10% of the state of Virginia, of the adults in the state, now have the app running. And you know, some scientists estimate it would actually take up to 60% of the population for it to really be effective. So that's part of the we just don't know part of this equation. And you know, it raises, you know, for some folks, what I think is an important question. Like, if this technology is unproven, why are we all installing it on our phones? Why do we believe that phones can actually help us combat the coronavirus? And look, I think those are important questions to ask. But the truth is, we're now at a point where a half dozen states have invested in this technology. They've made these apps through their state health departments. And so, you know, my advice to folks is, you know, if it's available, let's give it a try and let's find out. Because at this point, the money has been spent and we might learn something. And, you know, if you or just a couple of people do get these notifications, I'm sure you'll be glad you got it.
That's Jeffrey Fowler, technology columnist for The Washington Post. Thank you so much.
Sure thing.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.